We'll be in John 11 for the entirety of the lesson this evening. There's a book by Joel Osteen titled Your Best Life Now. Your Best Life Now. And you could read John 11 in such a way as to support what I understand that book to be saying. I don't think you'd be reading it correctly. Don't think you'd be reading John 11 correctly to end up that. But this book, to tell the truth, I haven't read it straight through. But, you know, I did look into it some and read portions of it. And it fulfilled what I had heard about it and expectations I had of it. And that is that he talks about in this book how if you just got enough faith, if you just can envision the promises of God for yourself, you'll have a lot of success. And sometimes he's real vague, and it sounds like maybe he's just taking the best light. Maybe he's just talking about spiritual success. You know, maybe that's all he's talking about. And you can kind of read it that way, and I think some people don't realize that he's saying something else. And he comes out and says things like, you just got to envision how your career can be successful. You got to envision how your education can be successful. And if you just have enough faith, God's going to bring that out for you. And it's all seems all nice and wonderful, except that that same false gospel crushes people then. I mean, it's a lie at the outset, and that's bad enough, but it crushes people then when they don't get success in a career, when they don't have success in education, when they don't get the mansion they anticipated in this life. It must be that I didn't have enough faith. When they suffer, and when people, their loved ones die, and when they're diagnosed with cancer and things aren't looking well, they must not have enough faith. Or the God that they believed in isn't coming through with his promises. So really, I think what you're going to have in John 11, cue title, is your best death now. That's, I think, a more accurate description of what we have in John 11. Some really hard things that happen here. You could oversimplify and say, well, we know. You already read maybe your title of your chapter there in your version. Well, Lazarus is going to be raised. And so life of faith brings about resurrection. You know, kind of simple line like that. Faith brings out health and wealth, very literally health for Lazarus. But I don't think it's that simple. I was struck by something. I've enjoy photography a little bit here and there, and not any good at it, but I try. And up in Milwaukee, I went out in the dead of winter in the snow, and I wanted to go over this beautiful scenery at this old Civil War era veterans hospital. You don't necessarily notice it because it's next to Miller Park Stadium, so that's huge, and it dwarfs this beautiful architecture, this old building, the veterans hospital. But it's a veterans hospital, and then all around it is a graveyard of little white gravestones, veterans memorial graveyard. And it just kind of struck me that you have a hospital, and then the modern one is there too now, next to a graveyard, you know, the place they go to escape and avoid death, and yet it's a next to a graveyard, a very strong reminder that they're all going to die. And then I realized, well, it's not just the hospital here that is that way, but what has the reputation for having graveyards? You don't think of a veterans hospital necessarily first. You think of maybe churches. Churches. Christians haven't been ashamed of associating death with their place of worship. And so it's just kind of loudly there in Christian history. The death is something we are not quiet about, not something we ignore, but that we face head on. And so in John 11, we're forced to think about some of those things. And if you're feeling like Mason, you're talking about resurrection a lot, you're talking about end time things a lot. One, we didn't spend a lot of time on end time kinds of things when I went through death, resurrection, and faith earlier in the year. But two, it's just because the text, as I'm working through the text, they keep talking about it, and that's part of the point. The text keeps on bringing up this idea and these ideas. So that's the main thing I want us to appreciate. But there'll be unique ideas here in John 11 that we haven't really worked on. And it's the fourth Sunday, and so I will make application, I think, comes from the text here as well, about evangelism. And so if you may have forgotten that, but fourth Sunday, I try to make sure I come away with some application relevant to evangelism. So be on the lookout for that as well. So the first four verses, let's go read John 11, 1 through 4. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. We don't have a ton about this family, Lazarus and Mary and Martha, but they're named individuals that you hear about in a couple of other places. Jesus spends time with them. And the interesting thing is, they're not from where Jesus is from. Jesus is from Nazareth. He's from Galilee. But here they are in Bethany, in the area of Jerusalem. And so it seems like it's those good friends that Jesus doesn't get to see all the time. But clearly good friends and disciples of Jesus. And so it's of this good friend that Jesus gets the message. Not just any message of asking for help, but from friends. Lazarus is ill. And then Jesus says what we might feel like we know where he's going with this, but they definitely didn't know where he was going with this, and that is, this illness does not lead to death. Actually, it ends up leading to death. But it is for the glory of God. Ultimately, it is for the glory of God so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. So that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Think about what burdens you. And we all have varying degrees of that. Suffering that you're experiencing. Is this true of that suffering? Plug it in. This suffering does not lead to death. It is for, this is the main thing, this suffering is for the glory of God so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. I'm not talking about making things easier. I'm not talking about this as a painkiller. But can we say this of our suffering? That it's for the glory of God. I think we ought to. I think this should be true of all suffering. We're supposed to be learning from these things, from these passages. Not just Jesus performed a miracle and leave it at that. But what's he communicating beyond that? It's what John's been doing all throughout. Jesus has been doing all throughout the book of John. Is, I'm giving you bread, but there's a bigger point here. I've changed water to wine, but there's a bigger point here. Again and again, he keeps pointing to the greater ideas. So we should see their suffering and make application to ourselves as well. And he's going to continue to develop this idea of it being for the glory of God all the way through the chapter, so we'll keep following that. Let's go ahead and read verses 5 through 16 as Jesus responds, or we see Jesus' response to this news. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of the world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. And Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." So Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." There's a couple of surprising things here. In the letter in the beginning that we already read, the message to Jesus was, "The one you love is ill."
Okay. can do this great fireworks, and now you know Jesus in doing these is now you know he's got proof of being the Son of God. The miracles are so much more than that. So at the end of the book, when John talked about, I've written these things so that you will believe, we have to fill in the context of John here that part of that is allowing your friends to die. That's part of the works that Jesus is doing. It's part of what his miracles are communicating. He loves them and is glad if it means people will believe. By the way, he's talking to his disciples who believe. Belief isn't, again, this static thing. They need to grow. They need to deepen their faith, both in terms of understanding and maturity. So we'll continue here. In verses 17 to 27, Jesus gets to Martha and Mary. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been dead in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask God from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe? She said to him, yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. She believes, like a good, faithful Jew at the time, that the saints will be raised in the last day. This isn't something she learned from Jesus. She's a Jew. And this is what the Jews, as a rule, believe, the exception would be the Sadducees. But the new information that Jesus brings here is that Jesus is the source of that. The Messiah is the source of that resurrection. He's very closely associated power of life and death with himself. She believes he's the Christ, but she doesn't necessarily understand that just how great he is. Again, to say what Jesus says here, to say I'm the resurrection of life, it's just like I've been saying all throughout the book, and when Jesus keeps on saying, I am the good shepherd, or I am the light of the world, all these things are really just claims of deity. I am the resurrection and the life. It's for Jesus to say that he is defined. And so understandably, Martha didn't quite understand that yet. And I think the thing that has more recently struck me the most about Martha here is being refreshing me, because sometimes I take a most cynical view of the person passage and you all are wondering what in the world I came away with that. And positively, Martha affirms confident faith in Jesus, even though Lazarus is 4 days dead. Even though she already sent a message to Jesus, clearly by his conversation, really hoped that Jesus would return and heal him. She has confident faith in Jesus as the Messiah, even though he did not heal Lazarus. Even though Lazarus died. That is a faith that stands out in the book of John. You gotta remember, back at the end of chapter 2, Jesus wasn't entrusting himself to people because they were believing in him because of the signs. He knew better than that. Right after that, we learn about Nicodemus, who is enamored by Jesus because no one can do these signs that he does without God being with him. A bit of cynicism again. She doesn't have that sign-based faith. She believes in Jesus without Lazarus walking out of the tomb. And you bet that's to God's glory. God is glorified through her faith. If you ended the story right here, God is glorified. Does my faith do that? Does it affirm confident trust in God after the tragedy? Ultimately, does the faith land on that kind of bedrock? Go through all the emotions that we're going to see Jesus himself goes through in this passage. But does it come back and say, "You're the Christ, and anything you can ask God, God will give it"? So in the next paragraph, 28 through 38, there's going to be some repetition, but don't be mistaken, there are new elements here being developed in the account. So let's just see what changes here as Jesus gets closer to these people who are grieving into the tomb. Verse 28. When Jesus said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." Some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" All right, let's call out the distracting verse there, because recently I mentioned something else is the shortest verse in the Bible in Greek, and then I had to qualify that. Well, this is the shortest verse in English, okay, everyone? We got it. Verse 35, we got it. Interesting that rejoice evermore, and Jesus wept, and you make a sermon off that again. All right, so we got to get that out of the way. Jesus is hearing some of the same things from Mary, but he's seeing the people weeping, seeing these sisters weeping, and he weeps. But that's not the only emotion described here. It's not just sadness. This is the nature of emotions, though, right? Can't just neatly categorize them. But it says in verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved. The ESV says, I think the King James Version says, groaning, or he groaned.
That's right.
It's the word that elsewhere is used for rebuke. I mean, again, it's Jesus might rebuke the disciples, and it's this word. So it seems like it's a little unfair to translate this word without including some indignance here in the word. And it's repeated in verse 38 at the beginning. I think I failed to read that part. And Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It's apparently an onomatopoetic word. Got that word out. I'm sure I correctly said it. Related to the snuff and snort of a horse. Got that out too. but this expression of indignance here. Well, how does that fit in the context? We're not always comfortable with Jesus being angry, especially if it doesn't seem to fit the context. There's a case in Mark 3 where weeping and just say, why? Why is Jesus weeping? I mean, is he so short-sighted? Does he know what he's about to do? He's about to raise Lazarus from the dead. Why is he weeping? And if that seems like a fair question, then we just need to pause, because we must be thinking about death in a very different way than Jesus. If we just think, well, there's no reason to weep because he's going to be raised in a few moments, we're not thinking like Jesus is thinking. Death is terrible. That's why it's so wonderful that God conquers it. That's why it's so wonderful. And not just that he does it in the next moment. In fact, it shouldn't make all that much difference that Lazarus be raised a moment or two later. She already believes, they already believe he's going to rise in the last day, so why are they weeping? Because it's death. Death is death. Death is not the way God intended things to be. So Jesus weeps. Jesus has this mix of emotions. And if it ends here in Mary and Martha's trust in Christ, it's all for God's glory. Just if the account ends right here. Let's go ahead and read on verse 38 through 44. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." So there's this reminder in verse 40. Believe, you'd see the glory of God. And that's that snippet that I feel like Joel Osteen, I don't know, might even be in his book. You just take that, whoop, put it in his book, just seems to fit right in. Believe, you see the glory of God. But in the context, God has already allowed Lazarus to die. Which, when we look at reality, is just a microcosm of the situation for all of us. Yeah, sure, he raises Lazarus from the dead, but hello, look around. That's not what the situation is for you and me. And for our loved ones. Our belief will turn out for us to see the glory of God no matter how long we have to wait. So, ultimately, in a different kind of way, the gospel is health and wealth. We're going to reign with Christ. We will be raised. In a different way. In a less self-serving way. We wait. Resurrection. Jesus didn't go from here and start raising everybody from the dead. He became a guarantee of that by sacrificing himself. You might wonder, well, I wouldn't necessarily want to be Lazarus right here. You know, he got to spend a few days in paradise and then take him back. There may be some truth to that. I don't know how that works exactly or what to think about exactly, but I feel like there's a little more to what Jesus is saying than just the practical taking wrappings off of him. I'm inclined to think Jesus is saying something more. He's been bound by death, and Jesus says, "Unbind him and let him go. Remove the stone." I mean, Lazarus is being freed from death. Now, it is a little bit different. My understanding would be, this is a little different than the final resurrection. Lazarus is going to die again. Jesus was raised never to die again. And that's what we'll experience, and Lazarus will experience as well. Let's continue verses 45 through 53, which you might feel like, well, that's not part of the Lazarus story, but John connects it pretty strongly to this. And what I'm wanting just to see it do is the causal connection between what Jesus does for Lazarus and how it really turns out to show God's glory. Here, verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? This man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. Nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. So verses 45 and 46 make the connection for us. They went. People who were there apparently to help Mary and Martha grieve, who said, "Couldn't this guy heal the blind? If he could heal the blind, well, why did he raise heal Lazarus when he was sick?" Some of these people went and reported to the Pharisees. And so the Pharisees fear his influence, growing influence. And it's exactly what the disciples feared in the first place when they first started going out. "Hey, you want to go back there? They were just trying to kill you. Why would you go back there? Now, here it is, Jesus." That's what we were trying to avoid. Jesus allowed Lazarus to die, raised Lazarus, but in terms of the way the events go, raising Lazarus cost Jesus his life. But that's not just true for Lazarus. All of us. The only way we're raised is that Jesus died. And so, as the high priest said much more deeply than and profoundly than he knew he was doing, one man needs to die for the nation. I mean, what did he mean by that? We got to kill him so we don't have any trouble from the Romans. But what did God mean through that? He dies. We can live. So verse 4, back in verse 4, when Jesus said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." There's some sense in which that came about when Lazarus was raised. I mean, do you believe to see the glory of God? But as I'm reading through John, I think in the bigger picture, it reaches beyond Lazarus and this one miracle to the cross and resurrection of Jesus. Throughout the book, he's been saying things like, "The Son of Man will be lifted up." And it's like, well, that sounds great. We'll be so glad to be part of lifting up the Son of Man. No. What does that end up meaning? He's crucified. The Son of Man is going to be glorified. What does that mean? He's going to be crucified. And he's going to rise again. Lazarus' resurrection ultimately is pointing to bringing us to Jesus' death and resurrection. So, some application points here. First, empathy, like Jesus has here. It opens doors for the gospel. So, you know, he didn't come in there, "Don't you guys don't have any faith in the resurrection? Can't believe you're all upset. You'll see him someday when he rises from the dead. That's not how he used the resurrection. He genuinely, probably more deeply, wept with them. And so don't avoid the hurt. You know, you missed. You didn't show up when people wanted you. You know, Jesus got this message. You didn't show up to heal. You didn't show up to comfort. You're there late. I'm the kind of person who, if it was hard getting there the first time, I don't want to get there afterward. As I'm saying this, I'm thinking someone very specifically that I wasn't there for like I should have been. I had excuses. I'm raising a little family, but I didn't visit him in the hospital when I would have liked to. And he was gone. And I was made very painfully aware of not being there for people. Jesus goes and he's with hurt people who could have held it against him. He validates their pain and he points to himself as the resurrection. And so we need to do the same thing. Have the empathy. Validate, understand, listen, don't avoid people, and point them to Jesus and the hope of the resurrection. So empathy, you know, we think, oh, evangelism, what kind of tools, what kind of gimmicks? Well, empathy, listening, your neighbors. Someone mentioned a prayer this morning, I don't remember who it was, but I was like, hey, that's sermon notes, but that there's people around us who are going through pain and hurt, and there's opportunities to point them to the true hope and salvation we have. So empathy. So second, something I tried to highlight as we went through is that believers need to be evangelized too. So I'm glad this happened so that you would believe. Who? The disciples. And not just, you know, the outskirts disciples, but the inner disciples. I know Judas among them. Mary and Martha, they need to grow in their understanding and their belief. So evangelism, we need to understand that we need to be evangelized too. We need to grow in the gospel as well. Encourage each other in that. Because even though it's like, hey, we're in the building and we've gotten each other baptized, there's souls at stake. You and me, our souls are at stake. And when we go through suffering, that's when things change a lot of people. That's when they either dig deeper into the faith or walk away from it. And so evangelize each other in the face of suffering. So empathy, evangelizing believers too. And third, personally, in our own lives, show how you're living your best death now. Show how you die to self and live for him. Several of you suffer in unique ways. I haven't talked to all of you about these things, but where some of the sacrifices and suffering some of you go through, your faith in God, through that stuff, you're glorifying God. Thank you. You're encouraging me. Be able to do what Martha did. Approaching Jesus who let your loved one die. Let tragedy happen. Say, I know who you are. I believe in you. You're the Christ. And that glorifies God. So, expect to be glorified, for God to be glorified in your life. Not in the way Joel Osteen talks about, that you believed hard enough and so you got the job you dreamed of. But by trusting in the God who purposefully allows you to suffer so that you can show your faith in him. You're going to see gravestone after gravestone after gravestone. gravestone in your life, literally, figuratively. But you've already seen one tomb opened and empty. So as one simple evangelism tip is left with you, have steadfast hope in God.